Tired of all the bugs in your yard? Enjoy your backyard again with Cutter Backyard Ready to Spray Bug Control at Menards. It kills mosquitoes, fleas, ticks, and other insects fast, controlling them for up to 12 weeks. A 32-ounce Ready to Spray container covers up to 5,000 square feet and is on sale now through July 13th. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards.
Can we talk something else? Can we talk about something else?
Hello. Out there. So, I've been out of commission when it comes to Dark Topic since around June 23rd. That's going on a month and a half ago. I have been eating well, exercising, smoke-free, drug-free, laying off the beers. I was rallying to become swim fit for this summer rather than bloated on the beach as per usual. I'd even been counting my stupid steps on my stupid phone. Well, my smartphone. I'd even started fasting from 9 p.m. to noon the next day, using an app to keep track of my progress, which I'd thought silly until about the third day when I found myself proud of the stats I was racking up. Thanks, smartphone. I really am stupid. What would I ever do without you? Then I got the message from my brother, quote, "It's about Dad, call me quick." And my health kick. Stubbed a toe. Lost a shoe. I just recently found my footing over a month and a half later and logged back into my health app. The fasting clock, still running from 6 p.m. June 23rd, said I'd not eaten for just over 1,000 hours. And of course that's not true. I gained 10 pounds in the last 1,000 hours. It's just that from the time I received said message from Leroy, I'd abandoned my little health app. I'd effectively clocked out. Guy, did you hear the news? I'd known what it was immediately, and I don't care if people think I'm being overly dramatic or attention-grabbing or I'm simply touched in the head, because as a true crime podcaster, I am all of that inherently. I knew that my father was a dead man. And I knew that my plans for swim fit summer had just sunk like a ship blown to smithereens. Welcome to Dark Topic. I'm your host, Jack Luna. This is a true crime happening. The dead man. I have a business through podcasting, Jack Luna Creative, and rarely do I ever get the chance to do anything business related besides drink beer and smoke cigarettes in the corner of my desolate prairie studio, my garage, typing away about horrible things that happen out there, beyond the summer's corn and canola, the ice lock of closed highways come winter. The death of my father, whom I hadn't spoken to since late 2019, who was in many ways dead to me already, still came as a shock since I'd always thought that I'd see him again. He died of a drug overdose, which I've covered some in the exclusive content. I am not here to investigate, though the details are shady and would be worth bringing some light to if the situation and characters involved weren't so unsavory, so easy to turn one's nose up at. A quick look at what's cooking in this situation, bubbling beneath the lid, makes you just want to slam the lid back on. That's what we got here, in the case of my dad's death. Yeah, his pockets were turned out. Yeah, he was woken up by some scallywag in the middle of the night to take a hit of fentanyl that knocked him right out of his body, but the reality is that this kind of thing happens all around the clock. And for such matters, authorities have little time. So I set my watch. The trip would take 15 hours of driven straight, but we chose to stop halfway, my girl and the boys, for business reasons only. Of course. It would be a true crime road trip. So off we go, east from middle of nowhere Manitoba to Kenora, Ontario, where the prairie gets hairy with scrubby little trees before ending in a roller coaster ride through the forested beard of the Canadian Shield, where the air smacks you awake or dead is the prairie. But this place, Kenora, the edge of flatness, is beautiful. Heading into Ontario, the gateway into Ontario from Manitoba, they call it Lake of the Woods, that area. You can get lost in a speedboat. It's so vast. The lakes, through the trees, Kenora. As a prairie guy now, in love with truly vast space, storms on the right side of the road, clear skies on the wrong, that's what I like. Kenora is where you feel exalted, but not quite right. It feels like standing over a dead body looking back. So once in Kenora, we decided to stop and go out for dinner, a dinner on the water. I had to fight for this dinner. They wouldn't allow us out on their patio. It was packed. They said the patio was closed because a storm was rolling in. I said, fine. And me and my business associates, that's my girl and my two little boys, walk away, try to find another place to eat. There's nothing there. Even though it's a really nice spot, there's not a whole lot going on in Kenora because it's on the edge of not a whole lot being Manitoba. We circled, couldn't find anywhere to eat, came back to that same spot on the water and saw people standing out on the patio, sitting as well, waiting to eat, it seemed. So I walked in and said, hey, you just told me we couldn't eat out here. And she said, well, a storm was coming in when you were here 15 minutes ago. And now the warning's gone. So come with me, sir. Mr. Jack Luna Creative. I go outside, I bring my family in. They're all embarrassed because of the way in which I handled it. And we get out onto the patio and had a nice meal, me and my business associates. Afterwards, I decided to take a walk back downtown where I had spotted a true crime hotspot, the CIBC. Or Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce, is still there in Kenora, though with a facelift from some video research I'd done previously. Back in 1973, it had all been brick and stone, and it had been stocked that late April that I remembered, and early May, I believe, by a man locals came to know as Pinky for the color of his plaid lumberjacket, an unusual tinge, pink. In such a place, even today. I walked the round as my family decided to go home. Sorry, my business associates decided to go back home. And I walked around remembering that I had read Pinky had done this walk 50 years past, scoping downtown Kenora out. There are a lot of banks down there, probably a lot of money in an area known as Lake of the Woods. Pinky had rolled into town on a westbound train, rumbling in round the bend from the woods, coasting in over Kenora like a curling rock. This old Canadian town has character. It's like stepping into a snow globe come winter, a miniature village in summer. Kenora is rough around the edges. That's why I had to send my business associates home. They're not as rough as I am. And this downtown is active with ghosts that remind me of the tough history here. The logging and the fur trade that ruled back when it was known as rat portage by French settlers. Rat as in muskrat. You can still feel the hum of it when a truck stacked with logs rumbles through town, having missed the bypass highway built beyond when Pinky walked these streets. Too charming, too quaint are these streets to be anything but something from a Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale. And why would I be thinking of the Dutch? Well, that is the accent Pinky brought with him back in 73 to Kenora. On his steamer trunk was stamped a name in bold lettering. Paul Higgins. This, of course, was an alias. Paul Higgins, with his checkered fedora pulled low, dark sunglasses, reddish beard, and short, stocky build, not to mention his pinkish lumberjacket, gave little away in his time spent in Kenora, except for the fact that he was certainly an immigrant. That accent, French, German, most likely Dutch, was the consensus, and it gave him away more than the pinkish plaid jacket and fedora. Paul Higgins wasn't from around here. The dead man, as I've come to think of him, frequented the same restaurant each day of his recon mission that lasted nearly 3 weeks. In that time, he managed to become high profile, despite the need to stay low. Maybe the accent, along with his eye-catching attire, was all a ruse. Maybe he ordered the same meal of ham and eggs with coffee each morning so as to become a fixture. The waitresses of the Plaza restaurant, still a fixture, Greek food these days, would eventually give up their attempts at small talk and simply bring Pinky what became his regular order, ham and eggs. And he always paid off with a generous tip. Accompanied by the absence of one from his cap, perhaps he continuously faced the large breakfast crowds who were tastefully positioned to look out the large bay window behind him as a way to burn his image into their minds. A false image, I believe, was the dead man's Pinky, Paul Higgins, who became known around town as strange and creepy in this May and April of 1973, before he decided to finally hatch his plan. That was to attempt one of the most brazen small-town bank robberies in Canadian history. Certainly the most explosive. The dead man stayed at the Canricio Hotel, which still looms over the downtown core. It stands not of fine standing, mind you, as it once did. Old hotels, brick ones that haunt the corners of such places, have a way of going to seed, worn out, along with their signage and the pressure to accept one and all over time to stay relevant. It's honest, at least. What could have been known about the dead man, a.k.a. Paul Higgins, a.k.a. Pinky, was never in the room. Number nine at the Ken, he was very careful to protect whoever he was. He paid the $40 a night dwelling off for a period of 2 weeks up front. This in cash. The dead man seemed to be flush with cash, and anyone brave enough to ask what Mr. Higgins was in town for, or what he did for a living, would be flush themselves with embarrassment, following an answer of stern silence. He spent his time sightseeing, a cruise on the waters in the immediate area, a firm look at the small airport, a bus ride out to a work camp, where he stole some dynamite as a Plan C for getaway, it would later be determined. All of this movement seemed queer to those observing Pinky. The fishermen lining the docks at dawn, including one named Kenora John, looked at him strangely, tried to speak with him, but he would never speak back. He began his daily rounds here each morning and then faced the breakfast crowd as a silent wraith of red beard and sunglasses, absorbing ham, eggs, and coffee, mocking them, it seemed. The hotel employees, where he stayed at the Camisha, they were so curious, yet forced to keep quiet with the promise of a fresh dollar bill, ever possible, if Mr. Higgins found you courteous. Kenora was intrigued for weeks by this strangest of strangers who seemed to be preparing for something, haunting the area. All questions came to an awkward answer when on May the 10th of 1973, after having spent nearly 3 mucky, dreary weeks of Kenora's off-season trudging around as the only tourist in a tourist town, thoroughly scoping out each bank, the dead man strolled into his chosen target, the CIBC, the Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce. His checkered fedora was yanked tight on his head. His pinkish lumberjacket was buttoned tight to the neck, but otherwise, save his red beard, he was undisguised. And I say that because if you've ever seen somebody with a beard and then without a beard, you know, you know them as a beard guy and then they're not a beard guy, tell me that's not a completely different looking person. Shocking, really. Over his shoulder was slung a bulky bag along with 3 or 4 empty duffels that would be used to carry the cash. He brandished 2 weapons, a rifle and a pistol. The rifle, for you gun lovers was a 30-odd 6 Parker Hale British-made safari rifle. How about that? The pistol was a 32 automatic with a 10-shot clip, and it was made in Italy. A dainty, elegant-looking thing in the dead man's hand. But his arsenal was carefully curated, and like himself, had much more to it than met the eye. The bulky bag he held over his shoulder was filled with makeshift bomb. So Pinky, Paul Higgins, the dead man as I'm calling him, chose the CIBC, this bank, and he chose it for its easy access to the branch manager's office. The dead man walks right in, without alarming the bank tellers or patrons, into the office, I mean, and he shows the bank manager his pistol, the rifle, and explains the explosive that he has in his bag. He knows there's a lot of cash waiting to be paid out to workers of a local paper mill, a sawmill, and all that, and he knows it's to be paid out tomorrow. This is a Thursday. He knows paychecks go out on Friday. This is around 3 p.m. this Thursday. He knows the cash is as flush now as it ever would be. His timing is no accident. They are counting the money in the vault. The dead man announces that he is here to take all of the bank's money, then makes an odd request of the bank manager, Al Reed is his name. He tells Al to phone the police. The bank manager has already pressed a silent alarm, but he happily makes this call as the bank robber casually slides on gloves and slips on a black mesh stocking over his face, yanking his fedora back down over top of it once disguised. There is a hole in the mouth, which, after fucking around in his bag and messing with an egg timer that begins ticking loudly, it really has nothing to do with the bomb, but he's doing this for the fear factor. The dead man fills his mouth with this clothespin he has attached to wires, and he bites down tight in the pin after first explaining to the manager that he wants everybody out of the bank except the two of them, and soon the authorities now summoned. This clothespin, I'll explain it further, it's a dead man's switch. He has the manager explain all this to police when they soon, hesitantly, enter the mostly deserted bank. The manager helps explain that if the dead man's switch were released from the robber's teeth, the connection would be made to explode the bomb he has in his bag, made of 9-volt batteries, an Atlas detonator, and half a dozen sticks of dynamite held together with rubber bands and black hockey tape. The bomb, which the dead man shows off to his baffled audience, one by one the cops, he gets about 4 of them to look at it, each in succession. Yes, this is a fucking bomb. It is a crude yet ingenious device connected to the clothespin dead switch in his mouth with wire. The bag holds this loud egg timer, and it's ticking away the seconds for them loudly. It's the loudest one he could find. Again, it has nothing to do with the bomb. It has nothing to do with the bomb, but he wants this for effect. It's theater. The only part of this contraption that is a ruse is this egg timer. The dead man means business. He wants the bank manager, Al Reed, and authorities to understand that this is no hoax. The egg timer and its loud ticking is simply insurance, though his deposit of terror on them isn't for a moment doubted as counterfeit. Wants to get a good look at what he's strapped together here. The exodus of customers and employees from the CIBC soon alerted the public of the bank robbery in progress out on the street. News travels fast in such places, but Kenora set a record for response time to a happening here. The local radio station across the street, CJRL, Kenora's, you know, hometown news source over the radio, they did most of the work by covering the robbery from its inception in play-by-play fashion. They're right across the street. The broadcasters please for the public to stay away from the downtown core. There is a robbery, specifically the CIBC, right downtown, folks, where a brazen bank robbery is in progress, served only to attract the whole damn town downtown. Hundreds, going up to just over 1,000, converge on the scene over the next hour until the bank became like a stage for a rock concert. Parents pulled their children from school early so they could join in on the madness. The whole thing became a circus real quick, and the authorities were instantly overwhelmed by what the dead man had created. I should double back for a second and tell you that while the bomb was being examined by authorities and deemed indeed an extreme danger, a drunk from the neighborhood bar stumbled in and began demanding to know what's up. The dead man answered by shooting his pistol at the fool's feet which then went running out and down the street. Kenora John was this drunk's name, that the dead man would walk past every day, and Kenora John would try to talk to Pinky as he knew him, the dead man, as everyone in Kenora knew him. Kenora John is this drunk who walked in, and he wouldn't be seen again for a week following that. Meanwhile, news of what the dead man had detonated went national over the airwaves with this report. Straight from the front row where Kenora newsmen and broadcasters stood drooling at their office windows across the street, incredulous that something so big could be unfolding at their laps. Quote, "The Kenora police are inside the Bank of Commerce on Main Street with the holdup man. We're told he is heavily armed and has threatened to blow up the bank with dynamite if he doesn't get what he wants. All of the customers and staff are released. Bank manager Al Reed apparently is the only person inside now with this holdup man. People are starting to assemble on the sidewalks along both sides of Main Street where the Trans-Canada Highway runs through town. Police have not yet stopped traffic." End quote. So when the officers finish looking at this bomb, there's four or five of them. The dead man, as I'm calling him, orders them out of the bank, save one. This cop that was held back was used to empty the tills into bags for the so-called holdup man. He got the cop, did the dead man, as I'm calling him, to do the bulk of the work. He's got his clothespin in his mouth, holding the dead man's switch. He's got his rifle and his pistol pointed at him. He's not fucking around here. It's like, you do the work. I'm holding guns on you so you can't get fucking, you know, a jump on me while I have to do that work. It's very well planned out in that respect. Meanwhile, outside, the traffic has finally come to a halt as police have locked the area down. And this traffic is the Trans-Canada Highway. Think about like the biggest highway through the entire country. I'm trying to explain it wherever you are. How about this? It's the only highway through Canada up in those parts. So you have RVs, logging trucks, cars, people trying to get to work, out of work. It's not super busy, but it is the only highway through Canada, and it goes right through town. The police locked that area down. Finally, the dead man becomes surrounded. It's by gridlock, and it's by police outside. It's an incredible situation for him to put himself in. Why would he do this? And what will be his next move? The cop left inside, his name was Lechkin, Corporal Lechkin. He's moving too slowly and emptying the tills. He's trying to buy everybody outside while his fellow officers time to figure out how to deal with this. The dead man slams his rifle into one of the tills, and his weapon discharges on the rifle. It's a high-powered rifle that goes blowing through the roof. There's actually another newspaper up top, company, you know, a fucking newspaper, a media outlet, whatever. And they all go running out the back door at that point. Things have become incredibly tense. Everybody, they better start playing by the rules, or this dead man is literally going to explode. The bank manager, Al Reed, he's ordered to begin opening and emptying the cash boxes in the vault. There's a problem, though. Al, he can't remember the combinations. And even if he could, there is a security measure in place where senior staff, like himself, know one code, which he can't remember, while junior staff know the other. In short, the vault's cash boxes require two codes each to open, but they're all the same codes. The codes are kept with the senior staff, but switched amongst the junior staff every 6 months for their side of the lockbox. So the higher-end employees, like this bank manager, have one code for the right lock, and the junior staff have a code for the left lock, and they're switched up every 6 months, so that that code's kind of, you know, in flux with who knows what it is. And they overturn the staff, so that that side of it's a little bit fucked up. He hasn't had to do this for a long time because the bank manager, I mean, hasn't had to do this for a long time because he has his employees, higher up employees, doing the unlocking of the vault lock boxes, the cash boxes, all the time. The dead man gets pissed when he hears this. You can't remember the fucking code? And you're telling me I need to have another side of the code? He almost drops a switch from his mouth. He's so pissed. He plucks it carefully from his mouth, ensuring a good grip with his fingertips so as not to set the bomb off, then demands the bank manager get the codes. I can't get the codes. I can't remember the code. My staff aren't here. Figure it out, fuckhead. Do what you gotta do. I'm not leaving here without all the money. After a quick brainstorming session, he figures out, along with the dead man, that calling the Plaza restaurant might get them in touch with the tellers, who likely are still in the area. It looks like all of Kenora is outside by this point. The bank manager knows that his employees like to go to the Plaza restaurant, the same restaurant the dead man, or Pinky, or Paul Higgins, as he was known, would go and sit facing everybody as they looked out onto the street and freak him out in the weeks previous. The bank manager calls this restaurant and is soon talking to a waitress. He asks her if his bank employees are there, and she says, I think a few of them are. He says, get as many of them as you can and have them call me at the bank. Not long after, the office phone, Al Reed, his phone, it rings 2 minutes later, actually, and the necessary employees with the codes are in the restaurant and are indeed available. Quickly, the bank manager writes down the codes on a withdrawal slip. Then he and the cop, who is still just emptying these shitty little tills, work with the dead man at their backs together to go over to the vault. And the dead man has his switch, his dead man switch, like a cigar between clenched teeth this whole time, between lips that spread into a grin once the cash boxes in the vault begin clicking open with these codes. A dozen of them, filled with cold hard cash. Corporal John Lichkin was relieved of his duties in this strange brazen robbery at this point. Once all the cash had been liberated, he's told to get the fuck out of here, go out the door. And he's had his revolver on him the whole time. But the dead man wasn't worried about that. The dead man at this point asks for the young cop's revolver before sending him at the doors, but he's met with resistance. Officer Lichkin apparently told the hold-up man to go to hell, then left the bank, frustrated for having been used as he had, helpless because of the dead man's switch hanging from the assailant's teeth. And this is the first time we get an inkling that maybe the dead man doesn't know what he's doing. It seems like he's got everything under control, but to me it's like, why wouldn't you liberate him of his revolver at gunpoint early on? And why did it happen as you're moving him out and you notice it hanging out of his fucking back of his pants? Hey, man, give me that. Now, go fuck yourself. All right, cool. Just odd. So, the dead man being satisfied with the money, it's over 100 grand in cash he's tabulated now, the equivalent to over $500,000 today in Canadian money. The dead man orders the bank manager, Al Reed, to contact the chief of police, that's Webb Engstrom, who was observing the bank in this robbery from a local jewelry store, which he turned into a battle station. All calls from the bank were now being directed to the chief, though there hadn't been any yet. They had overheard the call to the Plaza, actually, the restaurant. The message is passed on to the chief from the bank manager to arrange for an officer to pick the so-called hold-up man out front. They want to pick him up out front of the bank in a half-ton truck, is the order. When the conversation begins to enter a tone of negotiation, and the chief wants to talk to the dead man, Pinky, Paul Higgins, what have you, whatever you want to call him. I like the dead man. The police chief is suddenly met with a dial tone. He's not talking. This episode is brought to you by IQ Bar, our exclusive snack and hydration sponsor here at Dark Topic. And we're so excited to announce they've teamed up with Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry, on two special edition products. a salted caramel chip protein bar, and a yuzu mango hydration mix drink. And I've been eating a whole hell of a lot of salted caramel chip protein bars. I don't get sick of them. That's one thing I'll say about those. It's a great treat and decent for you, as well as the yuzu mango hydration mix drink. I mean, I'll have one before bed. I'll have one when I wake up in the morning. Something about it. I mean, really great flavor and makes me feel like I came back to life after I chug one of those bad boys. IQ Bars plant protein bars. They're mixed with clean, delicious ingredients that keep you physically and mentally fit. The salted caramel chip IQ bar that I just mentioned there, it has 12 grams of protein and only 1 gram of sugar, and it has brain-boosting nutrients in it like lion's mane, adaptogen. The Yuzu Mango IQ mix is a refreshing zero-sugar hydration mix that marries bold flavor and essential electrolytes for your body and lion's mane plus magnesium for your brain. Just mix with water for Michelin star taste and next level hydration. 10% of sales, I should mention, go to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, which supports the next generation of aspiring U.S. chefs. With over 20,000 five-star reviews and counting, more people than ever are fueling their busy lifestyles with IQ bars, brain, clearly I didn't drink my yuzu drink this morning, brain and body boosting bars, hydration mixes, and mushroom coffees. This is the snack that you should start stocking in your cupboards when you go to reach for that, you know, ice cream at night, that chocolate bar during the day. I'd suggest reach for an IQ bar. They sent me the salted caramel chip IQ bar, the yuzu mango mix. And I mean, again, I've been going back and forth on those, and I just can't believe that something so delicious could be so good for me. And right now, IQ Bar is offering our special podcast listeners 20% of all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. To get your 20% off, text DARK to 64,000. Text DARK to the number 64,000. That's DARK to 64,000. Message and data rates may apply. See terms for details. Could this be your summer of discovery? Yeah, with Rosetta Stone, it could be. Whether you're traveling abroad, planning a staycation, or just shaking up your routine, what better time to dive into a new language? With Rosetta Stone, you can turn downtime into meaningful progress. Rosetta Stone is a trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years. Their immersive, intuitive method helps you naturally absorb and retain your new language on desktop or mobile, whenever and wherever it fits your summer schedule. I've been using it to try to learn Japanese, as I mentioned already multiple times. I mean, Rosetta Stone and I are good friends at this point, and I'm surprised how quickly you can pick things up in bite-sized lessons. And what I mean by that is, like, if you're planning on going somewhere or interacting with someone who has another language underneath their belt or a country that is required to speak that language wherever you are in certain situations, you can pick up bite-sized things to get you by. And I really like that about it. And it makes you feel like you are learning when you haven't developed the entire scope of it. At least you have a foot in the door with these bite-sized lessons and learning with their true accent feature. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert. It has 30 years of experience teaching people. I mean, there's millions of users and 25 languages to choose from, including Spanish, French, German, Japanese, and more. Rosetta Stone is a go-to tool for real language growth, and you can learn faster, retain longer. The big thing with Rosetta Stone for me is that you get this lifetime membership with them when you sign on, and you just never know when it's going to come in handy. Whatever trip comes up in the future, you can prepare yourself with this in your back pocket. So don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential right now. Dark Topic listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
He's not fucking talking. He's making the bank manager do his bidding, and if it goes somewhere where he doesn't want it to go, he depresses the Back then, you'd have a phone with this, what's it called? It's like a button you press down on it, and you can hang up the phone. That's what the dead man does. Constable Don Milliard, a strapping young cop full of piss and vinegar, almost loses half of his tank when selected for the task of showing up to the bank in a fucking half-ton truck, unarmed. And that was a peeing a pants joke, full of piss and vinegar, losing half the tank. But seriously, in truth, Milliard bravely volunteers for the task that entails entering the bank unarmed to assist a masked maniac with a bomb hanging from his teeth in a getaway plan that seems improbable and most likely will blow up in his face, taking the young cop, he's also a father, he's also a husband, down with the dead man. A Town of Kenora truck is commissioned for the task. It was number 6 of the town trucks. I guess like a garbage truck or kind of like a, maybe, I don't know what the fuck it was. Like a, the town of wherever you live, they have trucks somewhere, right? And one of those trucks is commissioned. Constable Milliard pulls up to the bank in this truck. As requested, he has no game plan on his mind. He's not here to water the flowers or fucking dig a hole like the town workers were doing previous to him commandeering this vehicle. He's showing up. He just kissed his wife goodbye. He just put his fucking clothes on, his plain clothes on. He's like, hey, yeah, well, I'm here. You asked for an unarmed officer in a half-ton truck? Hello. And he comes into the bank. It's locked. He's got a knock on the door. They let him in. And as that happens, a police sharpshooter takes position at the north end of the street. It's about 100 yards away. Everything is happening very quickly. The bank robber isn't the only one flying by the seat of his pants here. They've barely gotten the traffic stopped on the Trans-Canada Highway in front of this situation. And the cop who is lining up with his 308 bolt-action Winchester rifle just got set up. They're dealing with the crowd. This is happening very quickly. So he's the only guy there. They do have police officers going up on the roofs, but they're not snipers. They're just kind of, what's going on? It's, again, happening very quickly. This is the only real gun they're going to have on the situation. Other than, you know, service revolvers from the police, but this is the only one with a sight on it. So this is 16-year veteran police sergeant Bob Letaine that has the Winchester rifle handed to him. And he's like, I wish I could get a little bit of a better of a fucking gun here, but I guess we're happening quick. Sharpshooter may have been a bit generous to describe him, but Letaine is the most trusted shooter, the most trusted cop that could shoot out there for such a task, his chief thinks. The task is decide whether or not to let this play out by the holdup man's rules if he ever comes out of the bank. Inside the bank, Constable Milliard, he is in plain clothes. Like I mentioned, he's frisked by the dead man. He is indeed unarmed. And then Milliard is ordered to pick up the heavy bags of cash that they've already assembled here. The bank manager, Al Reed, slinks away to the vault, forgotten. He lights his pipe, actually, and starts smoking back there. The dead man makes a show of turning up the egg timer. He can turn it up and it makes a louder noise when he does that. And he turns it up in his bomb bag so as to crank up his fresh assistant's fear. Then he exposes a trick beyond this egg timer's ticking by arming the bomb for the first time. Like a red light comes on, a little noise happens, a hum. Call him Pinky, Paul Higgins, or perhaps a poor planner, but you can't call the dead man a dummy. He had a real bomb the whole time. It's just that the dead man's switch, that clothespin hanging from his teeth, was never in danger of undoing him. Until now. He bites down on the clothespin, the dead man's switch, and holds on for dear life with his teeth, then motions for Officer Milliard to go out the doors. Sacks of cash slung over his hostage's back. And immediately there's an issue. A helicopter flies over and seemingly spooks the dead man. He pulls Milliard back inside the bank, causing a roar from the assembled crowd outside who's been waiting for some action. High drama. the townsfolk, they're eating it up. They don't understand what's going on here. They don't know there's a bomb involved. They have no idea that it's been told not to come downtown, which is like saying, hey, come downtown. Something's going on. And the news reporters are freaking out as well. Remember, they're documenting this live. We'll get to some of that in a second. The dead man, he had forgotten his rifle. The helicopter that had flown above was bothersome, but being without his rifle had been the reason for doubling back. Now, the masked man in fedora and pinkish lumber jacket pushes Officer Milliard, carrying heavy bags of cash on his back, back out the front door again. Milliard asks if the dead man wants the cash in the front seat or in the back seat. It's a nod of the head to the back of the truck, meaning Milliard will need to go up and around the truck rather than just popping it into the first door that he sees. Now that the bomb is armed in the dead man's teeth, he's not talking. He's just nodding and he's kind of shifting his eyes in answer. There's no more talking. Directly north, as I mentioned, and less than 100 yards away, Sergeant Bob Letang with his Winchester rifle can't believe what he's got in his sights. His fellow officer Milliard is walking away and around the truck, and the holdup man has turned to look at him, surveying the scene. It's a clean, square shot, and he takes it.
Ladies and gentlemen, a continuing report on the attempted bank robbery at the Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce on Main Street.
We've spoken to a number of people on the street who allegedly saw this take place, and it was just one smooth operation, walking into the bank, ordering the tellers out, and from there, nobody seems to know what's going on, because the man is holed up in the Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce. He's wanting safe passage out. And the police have been negotiating with the man. The area has been cordoned off. The passersby, again, have been moved back further. And they're just waiting now to see what happens. As I mentioned, the man is holding what is believed to be a device in his mouth. And from all reports, it would appear as though it's a bomb of some sort. Now, the police are standing by. The truck he has demanded is waiting out front of our station right now. The man is coming out. He's got a black stocking on his head.
The man is coming out.
He is carrying a clothes peg in his mouth. He is moving back into the bank now. He's got three duffel bags, apparently full with money. He has moved back in with his with the man, and they're waiting now to see what happens. Now they're coming back out again.
He is
a colored man. It's the clothes peg in his mouth. He is carrying a flight bag. The bomb has gone off. He's been shot. It's gone in front of the... Everything is just rancid. Ladies and gentlemen,
the
bomb has gone off, ladies and gentlemen.
Money all over the street.
You wouldn't...
A policeman has been shot.
A man...
Men are running. Two cars are completely heavily damaged. The entire front of the Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce has just exploded. A helicopter is flying over top now. The OPP are coming to the scene. Policemen are ordering people well off the street. Windows have been blown out literally all over the place. There's debris. There are pieces of clothing.
The policeman who is with the man appears to be not too badly injured. At least he's able to stand up. The bank robber is lying, and we would well and truly suppose that he is dead. All right, you're all right, love. You're all right. One of our office girls is in a state of shock. You're all right. Can someone look after the girls? One of the office girls in a state of shock. She saw it too. One could only assume that whoever he is no more. Now, there are a few mistakes made by the broadcasters there. That was not a colored man, just a man wearing a mesh black mask. A police officer was not shot. They're really excited when this happens. I mean, they just had a bomb blast happen and their windows got blown out. They're making a lot of mistakes. But the explosion did send Officer Milliard flying. It's an incredible blast that blows out every window on the street and eats some of the face of the CIBC bank behind them, made of brick and all that. The dead man, he's flying too, just like Officer Milliard was. But he's flying in pieces.
His limbs and internal organs are soon splashing down on the deafened crowd of onlookers, having so much fun one moment, being in complete fright the next, and disgust. It's a disgusting scene. There's talk of intestines hitting people in the face. You know, I laugh, right? Because it's hilarious that they're so happy. Like, oh, where's the cotton candy? Boom. A fucking liver hits them in the mouth. It's shocking, to say the least. And when the gore and dust finally settle, only the young cop in Officer Milliard and a dog who had been asleep in a nearby vehicle seem to be moving. The dog is running away, jumps out of this vehicle right where the blast happened, and the dog is unscathed. It resists picking up the dead man's leg that lays nearby. There's glass that begins sprinkling from the sky like a late afternoon drizzle. Officer Milliard, the hostage here, would-be hostage, I mean, to who knows what degree had this not happened, this explosion of his abductor, Officer Milliard is on his knees, groaning in the smoke. He's holding his stomach. The air smells of barbecue. Then the money begins fluttering down, and the crowd snaps out of its stunned silence, wipes the fucking blood and guts off their faces, and chaos ensues once more as they go to grab the cash. Officer Milliard, largely intact, thanks to the bulky bags of cash on his back when the explosion threw him 20 feet into the street, Milliard, he's in shock, holding what appears to be his exposed guts tight to his belly so that they don't fall to the ground. He is still deafened from the blast as fellow officers attempt to get him to let go of his grip on the pool of gore in his arms. Don, give us a look there. Let's see what's going on with you. It takes some coaxing, but finally the dazed officer loosens up and releases what indeed turns out to be guts. Just not his own. He's hanging on to the dead man's gore. The bank manager then exits the smoking mouth of the bank, smoking himself, that pipe still at his lips. Al Reed, he surveys the scene. What a mess. A bank clerk comes in from behind him. She runs up and taps him on the shoulder, and he kind of freaks out. Where'd you come from? She'd been downstairs throughout the entire ordeal. She'd been on her coffee break. Well, back to work, young lady. And she'd kind of hunkered down when she heard the gunshots at the floor for Kenora John and, you know, all the chaos going on upstairs. The bank manager takes a puff of his pipe, the smoke everywhere, and says, well, back to work, young lady. We need to get this money collected, don't we? The mayor of Kenora, he's on the street barking orders. Traffic is backed up forever on the Trans-Canada Highway. Kenora is a clogged artery of the country and needs to get moving now that this is done. The cleanup is rushed. Everything's so rushed in this story. The dead man is quickly collected into a body bag, as much of them as they can get. The street is swept of glass and the cash. For the most part, the cash was recovered. And the whole town got in on it. They commissioned young thugs and well-trusted people to bully everybody into giving the money back. They got everybody out there with brooms and shit to clear up the glass. And then they started waving through the traffic. Because this was embarrassing. This is fucking embarrassing. That we had to stop all this traffic going through Kenora to Manitoba and coming through from Manitoba or from Kenora out into the rest of Ontario. Let's get this thing moving again. It would take the rest of the evening for it to clear through town. And this makes me wonder about the dead man's getaway plan. How the hell was he going to get away in a large truck with traffic congested from the robbery? I don't think he thought about that. And since we're cleaning up here, I wanted to mention that the decision to choose to shoot the dead man, whom I've named as such due to the fact that he was a dead man walking with his harebrained scheme the whole time, that decision to shoot the dead man by Officer Letang was quite controversial. Myself, I initially felt, after surface-level research on this, after just walking through town and talking to a few locals and then moving on my trip to go see, you know, what the trip was all about was to go see my father who had passed away or his house. I thought that the shot was incredibly irresponsible from what I had seen on video, and it was unnecessary for Officer Letang to tank. But in walking through downtown Kenora and talking to some people, they explained to me that there wasn't a better way to have diffused that for, you know, that's a perfect way to say it, actually. I dug deeper in talking to people, and I also read his follow-up statements in court, the cop Letang who took the shot that blew up this fucking robber. And, you know, I'm converted from thinking it was a silly shot to take. Officer Letang was not a trigger-happy cowboy, as I first suspected. He had assessed this incredible situation quite well, in fact. Better than me, a true crime podcaster, you know, if you can imagine that. When the dead man had squared up, facing Officer Letang, his hostage and Officer Milliard walking away to place the bags of cash in the truck, as I explained, Officer Letang had recognized that the armed robber was standing between the bank and the truck, and he was alone. This, he decided, would be the best chance to end this thing with the least amount of casualties. And he was right. The shot went right through the dead man's heart. The explosion largely was contained by the truck and the bank that he was surrounded by in that moment, the dead man, and the only one seriously hurt was the dead man. It wasn't ideal, but it was damn near perfect considering the circumstances or the other prospective outcome of a shootout down the road, an explosion against the piled up traffic, or, you know, the thousand or so curious folk, townsfolk crowding in. I've been incredibly wrong before. But this, me walking into downtown Kenora thinking I had like an answer there and saying that it was a silly shot to take, this is way up there in how wrong I've been. What a shot. The people told me, like, Letang, Officer Letang, even made sure to drop the dead man, shoot him through the heart with a rifle he wasn't familiar with from 100 yards or so. And he did that. He shot to kill so as to avoid a shootout, which if he had maimed the dead man, the dead man would have walked out into the street in the shootout and eventually been shot and dropped his dead man switch and blown up civilians. You know, if this had been a video game scenario, as I said to one guy, his name wasn't Kenora John, but I don't know, Kenora Sanjay, the game would be over. If this was a video game, the game would be over after that shot. And the screen that you're playing this game on would be full of gold stars, fireworks, and celebration. You know, mission complete. High score, perfect shot. Paul Higgins, as the dead man monikered himself as, he was said to be from 435 Glen Drive Road in Toronto. Obviously, a false identity given at the hotel. When officers went to check out his room, room 9, some explosive material was found in there, mostly in the bathroom, and this was taken care of by bomb experts. There were reports of the whole room that he'd been in, that it had been destroyed as a precaution, and now they can't figure out who this guy is, but that's not true. Recovered in room 9 were identical items of clothing, meaning that he had sets of the same type of clothing. He seemed almost militant in that sense. There were beer bottles all over the place, cases of beer, cigarettes. It's almost as if he went down there thinking, okay, well, this might be the day, and it turned out to be the right day. He was still smoking butts and drinking beers and trying to figure this thing out. But man, beer and cigarettes all over the place, a man after my own heart. And there was a bunch of literature on surviving the Ontario wilderness, as well as clear provisions for a survival trip. Things like fishing rods, fishing nets, an axe, a food supply of concentrated goods, dried goods, maps marked with X's in the surrounding wilderness of Ontario, Manitoba, northern Minnesota, where he, you know, was hoping maybe to go hide out until the heat died off. Who knows what the complete plan was here, but he did appear to have one. You'd hope so. After all that, the dead man, or at least what's left of him, lies 6 feet beneath an unmarked grave of Kenora, Ontario. Efforts have been made to dig them up and attempt some DNA testing on the remains and get some answers, but for now, the investigation is still under wraps. Over 50 years later, this case has yet to find a resolution as to the dead man's identity. It remains open and fits the weather up here most months, along with the dead man's demeanor in the last weeks of his mysterious life. Pretty cold. And that'll do it. I must acknowledge my main source for this episode, a book written by Joe Rocco called The Devil's Gap. He was there. I've left a link in the show notes to his book, and I got some shout-outs here. Other than that shout-out, which is a very important one, Joe Rocco, The Devil's Gap. Check it out. Kyle Spears. Thank you, Kyle, for your high-level support on Patreon. Spears me right through the heart with a loving pain. Jennifer Marco. Hey, Paolo. Thank you for finding me. Keith Harris. Thank you so much, Keith. I love both your first name and your last name. Cool. So, thank you, guys. I'm just a little bit fucking tired now. My trip, it went well. Here's a clip from a conversation with my dad's best friend that I met. He lived in the house beside my dad. They were best friends. And if you want to hear the whole story behind my dad's passing, me and Leroy's dad's passing, you can listen on the exclusive feeds, that being Apple Plus and Dark Topic Patreon. It's all there. I won't continue. I won't do it all publicly. It's not fair to anybody. But here's a little snippet of that. And maybe I'll just smoke a cigarette first. Yeah, so the ride in, we stop in Kenora. I get caught up in this true crime tale. And then I go on and I go to see where my dad died. I hadn't talked to my dad since 2019. And he is, jeez, you know, I'm so hesitant these days. I used to be so free, so loose on these podcasts. He is around still. It's one of those things where if you've had anyone pass around, do you feel them for a while because you're thinking of them? You might smell them. You might hear a song that hits you and remind you of them very easily. You remember a lot of the good things and you start forgetting the bad things. And I'm going through all that. But one thing I want to share before I go. I had a supernatural experience, maybe three of them, but one that really stands out. And if you trust me, which you should, you know, you should. I understand why you wouldn't, considering the way in which I project myself at times. But I had this experience where I'm sitting in here and I'm about to talk to the man you're going to hear a short clip from, my dad's best friend. And I'm thinking about whether or not I should call him. And so there's a overhead light above me in my studio, a light on with a fan. And then I have a lamp beside me. And I'm thinking about it. I'm looking at my phone and the light of my lamp goes out. And then it pops back on. And the time I paused there is how long the light went out. The light overhead of me did not go out. Just the lamp beside me. So I called multiple times. We're friends now. Eyes cocked, doors locked, stay paranoid. I'll talk at you real soon. I'm going to snap out of this and things are going to be better going forward for me. I don't have any of that hate in me anymore, any of that weird anger I had. I only just miss my dad and remember the good times. It's been a very healing experience for me. It's been... You know, I'm really thankful my dad died of a drug overdose. I'm just fucking around. I'm fucking joking. Okay. All right. See ya. Talking to you soon. Big love.
He listened to you every fucking day. I had to tell him to shut the fucking thing off. I'm not joking. And I don't mean to be a dickhead, but I told him, yeah. Bro, shut that the fuck. And he would listen to your fucking what are they called? Podcast.
Yeah.
Over and over. I'm like, bro. Shut that the fuck off.
But I was trying.
Fucking times.
I was trying to talk to him through those podcasts, and I think you were.
Yeah, that's what he said to me. He goes, "This is how he's talking to me." Okay, I got a good one for you. One time, we go down to It's called like a poutine fest, right? Mm-hmm. And you go and there's, you go and eat like French fries and gravy, right? And it's in town. And I'm like, bro, let's go get some poutine. And he's like, okay. So we go down and I go and get the Baconator one with mm-hmm. the maple gravy. And mm-hmm. I was like, fuck it, let's try this. And he goes and gets one. He grabs his poutine and he throws it right in this big fat girl's face. She goes, what, you're not going to eat that? He goes, here, looks like you need it. Boom! And he smashes the whole fucking poutine in this fucking broad's face. I was like, what the fuck, bro? I'm looking around. Everybody doesn't know. People start standing. I'm like, I grab him. Bro, we run to the fucking van as fast as I can bring him. I'm like, drive! Move, motherfucker. He just smashed the girl in the fucking face with a fucking maple baby. We got away with it. True story.
That's what I want to hear.
Tired of all the bugs in your yard? Enjoy your backyard again with Cutter Backyard Ready to Spray Bug Control at Menard. It kills mosquitoes, fleas, ticks, and other insects fast, controlling them for up to 12 weeks. A 32-ounce ready-to-spray container covers up to 5,000 square feet and is on sale now through July 13th. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big.